Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
I love the old saying that parents are only as happy as their least happy child. But maybe that gives parents too much credit. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Paul Theroux's new novel, Motherland, tells the story of a family that orbits around a matriarch who, at least in the narrator's view, is delighted by her children's fights and failures. Even as her large brood moves well into middle age, this mother gossips and manipulates and plays her children against each other with Machiavellian finesse. To their Cape Cod community, she is a long-suffering paragon of Catholic virtue, still devoted even to the one child she lost at birth, and who, not incidentally, is the only one she is capable of loving uncritically. And although her surviving children remain nominally devoted to her, the narrator is keenly aware of her power over him, but unable to truly break free of her influence. It makes for a fascinating portrait of a family, and we are happy to have Paul Theroux on the show to talk about the new novel. Paul, welcome back to Think.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
The story opens with this family of grown children surrounding their father's deathbed in the hospital. And immediately we are introduced to this soon-to-be widowed mother as a woman who is ready for her husband's life to be over.
Yes. And I think there's a mechanism when a parent dies, when someone dies, husband or wife, father or mother, something happens to the family. The family goes into kind of imbalance. The surviving parent wonders where the loyalty lies, whether it's to the parent who passed away or to the survivor. And so in this case, the mother is dominant, and the father, who is a moderating influence in the marriage and in the family, is gone, and the mother reigns supreme and suddenly has she has an access of special powers and begins to tyrannize the family and play one against the other, as you said in your introduction.
The father here, who we only sort of see in flashbacks, is a fascinating character. He seems to have really enjoyed his children, but out of loyalty to his wife, maybe the only way to make his marriage work is to be harsh to the children. It would seem like a really wrenching way to be a parent.
Yes, he responds to the mother's cues. He's also a very enigmatic figure. He smiles, and he's very quiet. He doesn't say a lot, and he smiles. And so you think he's happy, he seems content, but his smile makes him enigmatic, and the fact that he doesn't do anything. He also wants to please his wife, whom he loves, and so he's the disciplinarian. And, of course, when he dies, then the mother becomes the disciplinarian.
Hmm. His one rebellion takes the form of this bizarre period in his life when he is performing in a minstrel show. And there are these confusing and awful memories of him as Mr. Bones.
Yes, you know, that's a figure of out of the 1930s and 40s into the early 1950s, there was such a thing as a minstrel show that certainly where I grew up, outside of Boston, Medford, Massachusetts, and then lived for a long time on the Cape, Cape Cod. They ended probably in the mid-50s, when the civil rights move, when segregation and agitation took place in the South. They were suddenly seen as a weird manifestation of race. But a minstrel show was white men and women putting on blackface and singing plantation songs. And I thought, good God, this is too much. This is too good to not write about, because it happened actually at our church in Medford. And my father was part of it. He wasn't Mr. Bones. He had a different name, and it was slightly different. I used his spell as a minstrel singer, but I gave him different songs, more telling ones. And then I saw it as an opportunity for him to show who he was. When he puts on blackface, he becomes very frank with the children. He becomes a tease. He becomes a kind of underdog, but a strange figure in the house. Suddenly, there's a black man in the house, man in blackface. He's got a wig and makeup. And he reveals these the tensions in himself in a black mask. And I thought, oh, this is great. It's a great conceit, let's say. And I thought, it's a way of also showing the mother in a different light, too. It's a very long novel, by the way, and I wrote it over a period of about 10 years in the actual writing, when I was writing other things. So I was able to do something which I don't normally do with a novel. I mean, when I wrote The Mosquito Coast, it took about a year, but maybe a year and a half to write The Mosquito Coast. And more recently, other novels are 6 months or a year, and the novel's done. This is a much more ambitious one. So the idea of using material from my past, my parents' past, and family, and then just thinking what constitutes a family, was something I was able to kind of set out. Because I was writing the book with my left hand as I was writing other books. I mean, I wrote The Lower River, a novel during this, and I also wrote several travel books.
It's really interesting here because this is not a memoir, it's a novel. The family you write about bears a resemblance to the circumstances of your own family. You didn't try to conceal that. Your narrator is writing in the first person, so I'm wondering if that creates challenges for you in keeping JP, the character, your narrator, separate from Paul, the author.
Yes, I can see that for a reader who's kind of deconstructed, that it may be a problem. It's not a problem for me. Mm. I mean, that writing is an act of ventriloquism a lot of the time. It's often easier to adopt that mask or that that tone of voice of a narrator and then to go with it. The narrator is not me, and in many respects, I'm sitting talking to you from Honolulu, Hawaii. I live in very, you know, pleasant circumstances, and I have geese, and I go swimming, and I paddle a kayak, and you know, I have a nice life, and I publish my books. The narrator of this book lives 10 minutes from his mother in a rented house. His children pity him. His family's quarreling with him. He's having a tough time. I won't say he's not a loser, but he's having a very tough time. He's sort of toward the end of his career, and he's not getting great reviews. He's struggling. He doesn't really have much money. He doesn't live in Hawaii. He's not having a great life. But I saw him as a kind of victim of the family, a victim of the circumstances of the family. And so he's a reliable narrator as far as the family goes, but it's not me.
There is real comedy in this book, and it may not be evident from what we've been talking about so far, but for one thing, there are always these questions about how much money the mother has, because she sort of portrays herself as being just, you know, a step ahead of bankruptcy, and yet money will present itself when she wants to use it to give to someone. And so JP and his brother at one point decide they're going to break into her home just to take a look at her checkbook.
Yes, they burgle. They become cat burglars. This I found very funny. Thank you very much for remarking that the book has a lot of comedy in it. And I will say, when you're writing a book and you write something funny, it's a great motivator to write a book and to be writing jokes or to be writing scenes that are funny, comic scenes. They're not easy to write, and it takes a degree of inspiration and I don't know, good luck, I suppose, to write something that's funny. But when you're writing for a reader, I'm always aware that someone's reading this and that I want to give the reader pleasure. I'm not trying to bend his or her ear and say, you know, stick with me. I'm Samuel Beckett. It may take 2 hours to figure this out. But I'm not posing problems. The episode that you mentioned, when the two grown men, brothers, are wondering where the mother's money is, and they say, I know, that's... Let's case the joint. Let's break in. And they actually do break in because the mother locks her house. So they've got to pick the lock and go in. And they're creeping around. And they're having the time of their life because they're like boys. They're, you know, a 10-year-old might do that. And they even remark that. And they talk to each other as though they're boys, wicked boys, delinquent boys, stealing from their mother. Or at least trying to figure out where her papers are and how much money she has. So this is a I don't know, it's funny how they react to it, how they get in, and their responses. And it's pure joy for them to be doing something in adulthood that a child would feel perhaps guilty about or conflicted about, but they know this is done, this is fun. This is just pure fun, breaking in. And then on another occasion, Jay, the narrator, breaks in, and the house is dead quiet. And then he sees his mother in a chair, and he thinks, my God, she doesn't respond. She's dead, he thinks. She's dead. He doesn't think, good, she's dead. I could burgle a house, or, oh, hell, she's dead. And then she wakes up and says, what are you doing here? So I don't know. It's played for laughs. I suppose it's dark humor in many respects. But Freud said one of the joys of life is to relive a fantasy of childhood in your adult life. You have a childhood fantasy. Suddenly you actualize it. You fulfill it as an adult. But it's something, you know, it's a childish whim, a wish that you've always had, but it's kind of fulfilled when you're an adult. And I suppose it's part of that, and it's part of living.
You mentioned that scene where Jay thinks mother has died. Throughout the novel, there's this expectation that she, I guess she's in her late 70s or early 80s when the story begins. Surely she will die soon, right? She's lost her husband, and yet she hangs on and hangs on past her 100th birthday. It's almost like she wants to deny them the relief of being gone from their lives.
Yes, and I may say my mother lived to almost 104. So my mother is an informing presence in this book. My mother is not this woman in the book. Mm-hmm. I mean, the woman in the book belongs in jail. My mother is actually a very kind woman, or at least something. But the when a parent lives a very, very long time, they go. There are different moods. I mean, they're not the a parent is not the same at 70 as they are at 80. Not the same at 80 as they are at 90. And when they're over 100, you think, what next? I mean, after I suppose in their 90s, a lot of first they're forgiven for everything. Then they're like a little glowing goddess in the how this woman is. So she has to be forgiven. But to live over 100 and still be sentient, talkative, manipulative, over 100 is, you know, it's an amazing thing. It's as I say, a lot of the things in the book are fiction, but many of them are drawn from my family and my life, and they were just too good to not use. My mother lived a very long time, and I saw the arc of her life was really amazing. I mean, that it encompassed all the technology of the 20th century, you know, from my mother was born before the First World War, and then, you know, she saw the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. So went through Vietnam, World War I, World War II, all of that, all these presidents. And my mother was actually a liberal. She used to vote for Ralph Nader, actually. But the woman in the book is different from her, but the arc of the life, the age of the woman is just amazing. And any listeners out there with a very, very old parent realize that, you know, you think, what are we going to do? What should we do about mother? You know, mother's now 98 and she's still perhaps walking around, still talking. And, you know, how much longer is there? You're glad that she's there, but you know that it's going to become a problem.
My guest is author Paul Theroux. We're talking about his new novel. It's called Motherland. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux. His new book is a novel. It's called Motherland. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. At the heart of this story is the chasm of truth between the public perception of this family as big and happy and the reality of complexities and private miseries within it. From a distance, people see the family as lovely. They see the mother as this kind of saint. And she is delighted to let this illusion persist and maybe to believe it herself.
Yes, but I think a lot of families are like that. I mean, a family is like a nation. A big family is like a very complex nation. It's not like, you know, they say happiness writes white. Happiness has no history. This is not a happy family. It's a very conflicted family. But that's why it's a novel. Very few novels are written about happy families. I mean, the Tolstoy line right at the beginning of Anna Karenina is apposite there. So the family has its own language. They have their own customs. They have their own rituals, like all big families. And they have their own language, their own way of teasing each other, egging each other on, and their own and ways of encouraging too. So it's like a little nation. It's like, you know, I joined the Peace Corps in the 1960s, and I went to Central Africa, and I saw lots of analogies between people living in the bush in the Assaland, which later became Malawi, and my family, just the way they carried on. And it struck me then, and in the writing of this book, that my family was like a little tribal, a little clan that you might find in the middle, you know, a clearing in the jungle or in the bush in Central Africa. And people would study them. You know, many people did study African people, Victor Turner and Colin Turnbull and all this. And they would say, gee, these are weird, the rites of passage of this for this tribe in Uganda or Malawi. That is very, very strange. But I found that true of my family. It would be hard to explain to an outsider just what went on in the family. So the public face of the family, as you put it, I mean, the public perception was it's a big happy family. That's normally how they would be described, big, happy family. Productive, children doing well and so forth, but they have no idea of what's happening inside the house, of the tensions in the house, and birth order is so important, and the tensions between the parents. Ours wasn't it was a conflicted family. It wasn't violent or anything like that. It's more subtle than that. I also thought that people didn't understand. They think, well, you came from a big family, you became a writer. I think I became a writer because my family was dysfunctional. I think that, and I perhaps became a writer because although people saw my mother as, you know, I always think of Michael Phelps' mother driving him to the pool every day in the early morning. And then when he gets on the podium, he says, and this medal, Mom, this gold medal, or these, but he actually got a lot of them. These are yours, Mom, as much as they are. And thank him, winking at his mother, and his mother weeping and smiling. Well, did you ever hear of a Nobel Prize winner dedicating the dedicating the prize to the mother? I mean, it just never happens. That Hemingway hated his mother. Henry Miller disliked his mother. D.H. Lawrence, F. Scott Fitzgerald, they all had problems with their mother. Now, it's not the mother's fault necessarily, but in a way, the mother helped create the writer, helped by a kind of resisting, and that writing is an act of rebellion. People who write are writing to prove a point, to show who they are, to mark out their territory. And so they do it in defiance of a parent often. And, you know, and I suppose in my case, it was that too, that you can't become a writer unless you leave home, go far, far away. And as I say, no one, that because the public and private perception of the family, as you put it, you don't understand just the dynamics of how a family forms someone, or maybe makes the person you know, delinquent or rebellious or something else. But in my case, I really wanted to prove something. And when people say, "Oh, you must have been a great reader. I'll bet your parents read to you and they encouraged you," well, they did up to a point. But I mean, My mother was more invested in us getting a job at the Stop and Shop and bagging groceries than going to the library, actually.
You talk about, you know, and many people know your work as a travel writer, but you talk about observing from a distance and thinking back on your family and the fact that as a little clan, it had its own culture. And in this novel, we see that there's a strange custom of gift giving in this family, which is the kind of thing that Americans notice when they travel abroad and see other cultures who do things differently. In this family, the rules are understood to be inviolable, but they seem to hold the weight of like diplomatic protocol. If you don't show up with, you know, a wheel of cheese and whatever, a new jacket for someone, everybody understands that you've broken a rule of this family.
Yes, but there's also a cynicism about the gift giving that a lot of the gift giving was hostile. You know, some people give presents because they dislike you. They want to obligate you, and so they give you this present, and then you owe them, or they owe you because you've given them the present. So there's a lot of hostility in the gift giving. There's also this sense that if you got a present in this family, there's a general sense that it's something that the person didn't want. In other words, if they're giving you a book, it's not their best book. If they're giving you, I don't know, whatever, a fountain pen, it's an inferior one. It's a sense they're not really giving you something that you want. It's giving you something that's they're discarding from their life. But that also is a characteristic of folk societies, the societies that we're talking about. I realized, by the way, when I was writing the book, that I'm replicating the life of a bush community or a tribal society, or I began to understand Chairman Mao when I was writing about the mother, or Pol Pot, or Mussolini. You suddenly realize what power is, how people use power, how they use spies, how they use gossip, how they use secrets, that all of that is part of the power structure. It's a family, though. And I may say, too, that a lot of people who are writing, I mean, people who are listening to me now may be writers, and they're writing about their families. You don't really understand your family. I didn't understand mine until many years went by. Often that's the only thing that you have to write about. It's your material. If you're 21, 22 years old, your material is your family. That's who you came from. My first material wasn't my family. It was, I didn't write about them. I wrote about, I joined the Peace Corps. I went to Africa. I went to Southeast Asia. I was in Vietnam. And so I wrote about them. I wrote about Singapore and India and Africa. It was very late in life that I began to understand the family, and gift giving, that mechanism of gift giving was part of it. And also, I saw how my parents influenced me, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, and how it accorded with the lives of so many other writers. Virginia Woolf's mother is in To the Lighthouse. And as I say, I mentioned D.H. Lawrence's mother is in Sons and Lovers. And I saw how they dealt with the mother. George Simenon, for example, had a problem with his mother. And after she died, he wrote a book called Letter to My Mother. It was just about how he felt his mother let him down and denigrated him. And I mean, it's one of his better books. You know, Simenon, the guy that wrote The Maigret and the also many great novellas.
Yeah. There's a devastating line, speaking of mothers, that Jay has in the book, which is that he says of her, "You never forgive someone who forces you to lie."
Yeah, that's true. The mother interrogates him and nags him. When we're nagged and interrogated, often we think, I just want this to pass. So it's why under torture, people lie. It's why torture doesn't work. People do anything to resist it. So they say, I'll tell you what you want to know, or I'll just tell you what you want to hear. The mother, who is pretty economical with the truth herself, forces various members of the family to lie. And it's true that when someone puts you in that position, you think it's very hard to forgive someone who makes you lie, and because you've kind of betrayed yourself as well as betraying them. On the other hand, you know, the idea of never forgiving, I mean, that's That's something I think about a lot, which is forgiveness, compassion. And if you travel, you go to places where people don't forgive. The Middle East is a classic example. It's just the societies of Israel, Syria, just to name two, where there's just unforgiving, never forget, never forgive. Then you go to a place like Vietnam where after we bombed, napalm caused Agent Orange cancer and so forth, you go, but they say, you say, I'm an American. They say, that's all right. You didn't, your government did it. It wasn't you personally. Have some noodles. So you realize the power of forgiveness. And I thought dealing with this book, the book allowed me to understand the nature of my family and the nature of the big family, and that forgiveness is a very big part of it too.
So the mother here is only truly happy when her children are pretty miserable, which is maybe the worst thing you could say about a parent. And as a reader, it made me wonder why. But your narrator doesn't wonder for a very long time what caused his mother to be that way.
Yeah, it's very hard to find. You know, there's a line about in the childhood of Judas, Jesus was betrayed. In the childhood of Judas, Jesus was betrayed. So there was something that happened in, I mean, a Christian theologian would say, well, Judas is a mechanism of Christ's being crucified and redeeming mankind. So that's one way of looking at it, that Judas is a very, very important figure. But then but this other light, which is in the childhood, in our childhood, we're formed in our childhood. And the mother is a mystery. I never really understood my mother's childhood. My mother also came from a big family. And so in the book, I deal with that a bit, but I never really engaged. I never really knew. What it helped me understand, though, how when you look at the childhood of many dictators, Stalin was, you know, grew up in Georgia, and he was in the choir in his Georgian town in the Christian choir, and he was in a little monastery and went. But he was also a thug. He became a criminal and a killer. Mao came from quite a good family, and a landowning family, and but he had acts of rebellion too. Pol Pot was an intellectual in Paris. My mother and the mother in the book, bit of a mystery, but you know that there was some dysfunction in her family. And my mother, being a woman, being in a family with boys, possibly formed my mother's character because they preferred the boys in the family. And I suppose that my mother and the mother in the book have that in common, which is that they needed to assert themselves and having got out of the thumb of their families. So it's about, I suppose, family power, family tensions. When you're writing a book, you tend to be able to see these things clearly. But I was never really able to see my mother's childhood clearly. My mother didn't talk about it. And that might be a clue that the things that people don't talk about tend to be very important.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Paul Theroux. His latest book is a novel called Motherland. I want to talk about Angela. This is the child, the mother's child who died at birth. And Angela becomes this kind of guardian angel figure almost for the mother, and the only one that she loves uncritically. Meanwhile, the narrator, for a variety of reasons, gives a child up for adoption, and that child is never mentioned again. It's like the child is eliminated from everyone else's consciousness except the narrator's. And that's an interesting comparison of those two experiences.
Yes, the child that died at birth is eternally present, or present as a palpable figure, and in a way haunting the motivations and haunting the dreams of the living. And then there's a child that's given up at birth to an adoptive family, presumably, and He is not mentioned. He's because that's a shameful thing. But one of the, I mean, it's not a spoiler alert, I suppose. But then that child reappears. Hmm. He reappears. He comes back, and there he is. Furthermore, he's happy. He's wealthy, and everything's, you know, hunky dory with the child that reappears. The Angela figure, who is the this is something which is entirely fictional. In the book, in other words, it didn't happen to my family. My mother was not obsessed with a dead child. It is important on several grounds. Is that she's Angela. She's the figure that helps the mother make decisions and so forth. But then the mother has a caregiver, and the caregiver is called Angela. And my mother never had a caregiver like that. But the narrator in the book then falls in love with this Angela figure who's Mexican. And so there's the dead Angela, there's the reappeared Angela, there's the Angela the caregiver, and then Angela the Mexican who is the object of desire. So it's a little much more complicated than the child given up at birth who then reappears and just becomes a member of the family again. Hmm. But that's an extension of the whole thing. The real and the surreal, I suppose you could say.
Did you wait to publish this novel until after your mother had died because some people that knew her might have tried to see a resemblance to her?
Yes. I wouldn't have published this book while my mother was living. The other thing is that as my mother went on living, and I mean, I wasn't living 10 minutes from mother as the man in the book, but I found that what was happening in the family, because there were certain resemblances, of course, to be worth noting down. I became what a writer is. A writer is a witness, an eavesdropper, someone patiently noting behavior. And I found that, yeah, my mother would have been upset by the book because she would have confused the woman in the book with her good self, and I didn't want that to happen.
My guest is author Paul Theroux. He's a travel writer and novelist. His new novel is called Motherland. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Paul Theroux about his newest novel, Motherland. If you'd like to join us, you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Some of my other favorite scenes in the book, comic scenes, are the birthdays. Of course, as Mother gets much older, everyone's sort of required to honor these landmark birthdays. And, there are these parties that are meant to be celebrations of this long life, and they sort of devolve into people arguing over who's sitting where and who ate an extra piece of cake and who invited a guest. And that felt very real to me in a way. It's supposed to be the most wonderful moment ever, and it's not so great.
Yes, parties can be painful. Parties in a big family, especially painful. You're required to show up. You know who doesn't want to be there. You don't want to sit next to all the anxieties of childhood, the old hurts, the unforgiven moments, and so forth. All are revisited upon you when you meet. Get together. The only happy person, of course, is the parent. In this case, mother, who's there as the guest of honor, and the children are kind of jostling around, either giving presents or not, and examining each other. You know, who's bolder, grayer, fatter, thinner. You know, so they're still kind of contending. And I think that one of the things that gave me a lot of pleasure in the book was the realization that at a certain, you know, that here are these older people, much older people in their 60s and then later in their 70s, who are behaving like children. Mm-hmm. And I kept having this image of them as old children, just children in short pants, just, you know, senile or elderly children. And it's not really a second childhood, but they really are like children, behaving like children, and the mother's still behaving like a mother. When a parent lives to a great age, I mean, she still has her children. You're still children. You're still brothers and sisters. You're boys and girls. You're not men and women in the full sense of the word. And the parties, the painful parties, sort of bring that out. Also, a party is for, if you're writing a novel, a party is a scene. It's something where you can, it has a beginning, middle, and end. And I published several of these as short stories. They seem like short stories because they have a point. And there's a, this action, and there's consequences. So, yeah, there are a number of them. There's the holidays, you know, there's Christmas, Easter, and Thanksgiving, and then there's birthdays. And the mother insists on celebrating them all in the way that, you know, a head of state will want a birthday celebrated, or the national day or whatever. It's got to happen. It's got to happen, you know, and it has to be right. There has to be flags and a bonfire and presents and songs. And it doesn't matter whether people are unhappy. I mean, I'm sure Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who's killed about 500,000 of his people, I think, and displaced millions, insists on, you know, celebrating all the holidays, his birthday and all the rest of it.
She wants her grandchildren there, but she is, she does not care for them at all.
Yeah, the mother in the book doesn't like little children. She's sort of seen it through. She's had her 7 children, 8 counting Angela. So there's, I mean, one of the, it begins by saying there were 8 of us and one of us was dead. Having gone through that, this may be true of some families. It was sort of true of my family. My mother, she tolerated little kids, and but she wasn't a grandmother in the full sense. I mean, and the woman in the book, that's a match with my mother and the woman in the book of vaguely tolerating them. But the woman in the book actually dislikes little children. She sees that the children as taking away the attention of her children, that her children are dominated by her grandchildren. And so she wants her daughter's attention, not her grandchild saying, you know, mommy, I want this. She says, you know, get that little kid out of the way. I want your attention. Hmm. So the grandchildren are an interruption and a distraction from the attention that she demands from her own children.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Karen calling from Dallas. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Chris.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that it's such a treat to speak with Mr. Theroux. I read his books in the mid and late 70s when I was going to school, and I enjoyed them very much because I liked to travel, and they were just so well written and interesting. And I read fiction as well, like The Mosquito Coast, and I understand now why I latched onto them, because my family was also kind of large and somewhat dysfunctional, and they were very imaginative, interesting books. I just wanted to say thank you for your books, and I feel like rereading them and reading this new book as well, because there may have been insights. I know they seem very insightful books.
Thanks
and
for
thank you. Thank you, Karen. Karen, thanks for mentioning The Mosquito Coast. The Mosquito Coast is about a family. That's the only other book that I've written which is about a family. I mean, I wrote that book in 1981. It was published in 82. So that's a whole family. Strange father, compliant mother, confused children. And then he, as you recall, takes the family away, takes them into the jungle and says, okay, we're going to start our own society here. And that's the Harrison Ford figure saying that. But that's a family. That's a family. And actually, the father in that family, the father in the Mosquito Coast, somewhat resembled my father. My father used to test us in the way that man did. So my father was a very big influence on my writing The Mosquito Coast. But I should also say my father never read the book, and nor did my mother ever read anything of mine. I mean, at least my mother never showed a much interest in my writing. But anyway, the mosquito, that's the other family. I think to write about a family is a very, very difficult thing. You have to know a lot, and you need a lot of time to absorb it all. So, Karen, and thanks for reading my earlier books.
When I read The Mosquito Coast, I was closer to the age of the son who narrates the story than to either of the parents. But my memory is that the mother sort of disappears in that story.
Yeah, the mother is the mother is kind of subsumed. Mm-hmm. But that's not unusual. You know, can you describe Huckleberry Finn's mother?
She was
absent,
right?
Well, she doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Huh?
She's gone.
She's not there. Yeah, she's not there. His father's a drunk. So Huck Finn really doesn't have a mother. But the mother in the Mosquito Coast just goes, she admires the husband. She laughs and she goes along with it. And he calls her mother. Mother, let's do this. Mother, let's do that. And in a way, she doesn't control him. She doesn't, she enables him, I guess is what you would say. But then in the end, she survives. And after he's, you know, at the end of the book, you know that the mother will kind of look after things. So she's important in that respect. She's the one who survives the ordeal in the jungle.
Do you imagine lives for your characters later? I mean, the children in that novel would be in their 40s or 50s now.
Yeah, I do imagine them. And I'm not going to do it, but it has occurred to me that I could write a book about the surviving child. I met someone the other day who grew up on a raft. Outside, the raft was moored outside Provincetown. Her father went under the name of Papa Neutrino. There's a book written about him called The Happiest Man in the World by Alex Wilkinson. So I met this woman. I said, what was it like? And she said, it was like the Mosquito Coast. But the woman I met was, you know, middle-aged woman, and she had survived this strange, crazy, but a very imaginative and kind of funny father, Papa Neutrino. And she'd grown up homeschooled on a raft. Well, I mean, that's very similar. And I said, did your father ever read The Mosquito Coast? She said, oh, yeah, he loved it. So there you go. But you're imagining the afterlife of characters. Yes, I do. I do think about it. Because they go on living. They live in your imagination. And they don't stay as fixed entities in the book. They sort of, you see something happen to them and in the book, the drama in the fiction. And then I imagine them, you know, in later life, marrying, having children, being grandparents and so forth in the way that I have. I should say also that, you know, writing is a way of making sense of your life. And, you know, my books are about my life. My travel is about my travel. And the books that I've written are all, to a very large degree, autobiographical. None more than this, than Motherland is an autobiographical novel, but with taking a lot of liberties with it.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Paul Theroux. We're talking about his latest book, the novel Motherland. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I would imagine that it would hurt me if I put as much effort into writing as you have throughout your career, and my parents didn't want to read what I'd written.
You imagine that it would be painful. Do you know, I think I said earlier, I write, and many people write as an act of rebellion. You start writing because in a large family, no one listens to you. No one listens at all. People just talking all the time. Mm. So writing is a way of getting people to listen to you. The idea that a parent doesn't read your book is sad because only if the parent reads your book will the parent truly understand you and will understand your feelings, your experiences, your sensitivities, your reactions, your emotions. People who read my work know me. They know me pretty well. I've published 50 books, mm-hmm. more than 50 books. I first published my first novel 50 years ago, 1967. It was called Waldo. The fact that my parents didn't read my work it disappointed me, let's say, because I thought if they read it, they'll understand me better. But they had other things to do. My parents had to raise a lot of children. So I understand the time factor. And my parents did read, but they wouldn't have read my sort of books anyway. I mean, my parents read travel books. They read Richard Halliburton. You may or may not know Richard Halliburton. He wrote The Royal Road to Romance and Seven League Boots. My mother read Taylor Caldwell. My father read history. They didn't read Henry Miller. They didn't read William Styron. They didn't read Faulkner. They didn't, you know, that wasn't on their radar. But they would have known me better if they had. That's too bad. But you know, my rebellious spirit was sustained, I suppose, even more by them not reading me.
What about your siblings?
They do read. They haven't. No one's in my family has indicated that they've read this book.
But you know they have, right? Because a form of them appears.
Must have, yeah.
Yeah.
But they haven't indicated it, and I suppose that's true to the passive aggressive nature of a family, which is that the very fact that they haven't responded means that they probably have read it. But I published a book 2 years ago. Called Deep South. It was about my travels through the South.
Yeah, you and I talked about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a great trip. I mean, and very revealing for me, as we discussed. No one in my family has mentioned that book to me. And it was a lot of it was about growing up in the North, reacting to the death of Emmett Till and to segregation and the integration of schools in Arkansas and all that, and Mississippi. And so it was kind of lived experience through the family. No one's ever mentioned it. I mean, I published the book. It came out. It was on the bestseller list. And it came out in paperback this year. You know, everything's fine. No one mentioned it. Not only did no one in my immediate family mention it, no one in my extended family mentioned it. So it's like, but other people mentioned it. You mentioned it. But that's not odd. That's not odd. I've talked to a lot of writers who say, I say, well, do your family read your book? And they say no. You know Annie Proulx?
Mm-hmm.
One time I met Annie Proulx at a literary festival. I said, where have you been lately? She said, a family reunion. I said, a lot of people. She said, yeah, there were about 50 or 60 people there in Maine. I said, what do they think of your work? She said, no one mentioned it. I said, did they see Brokeback Mountain? She said, no one mentioned it. I said, did anyone mention anything that you've written? She said, no. So, I'm not telling stories out of school. I'm just saying that she went to a family reunion. She's there. Annie Proulx, great writer, major film, and she's still writing her head off. And no one in the family mentioned it. I said, she said, do you think that's strange? I said, no, that's, you know, welcome to the family. I understand that. I suppose there are families that do read, but there's a sense in which writing is somewhat disreputable, and I suppose it fits that. You know, is he really on our side or is he spying on us?
The new novel by Paul Theroux is called Motherland. Paul, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for making time for us today.
Thanks, Chris. Great to speak with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and we're on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. You can find the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.